All right, bud, you ready?
Yep.
Let's do it. All right, everybody, welcome to the Renegade HPG podcast. We've been on a little hiatus as I've been making humans and raising humans, but the chaos has become a slightly controlled chaos here at home. And so hoping to dive back into these podcasts for you guys and kind of going back to the origins of the podcast. And so Renegade HPG, our very first episodes, we're really diving into the BattleTech trading card game and doing some discussions and deck building strategies, kind of drawing from my own time listening to X-Wing Miniatures podcast and just like, you know, how much I benefited from that strategy. And I'm looking forward to doing that higher level stuff today. And so my guest is Kevin Michael. So Kevin is a veteran player of the BattleTech trading card game and has been doing extensive, and extensive is kind of maybe an understatement, thousands of hours of work over the last several years, really breaking down the game, breaking down the meta, understanding the game, and has created a series called The Gauntlet, where he's worked through pretty much, I think, almost 100 decks, you know, maybe in the meta, different archetypes, and just kind of analyzing them against each other. It's an amazing resource that has been for the community, but we haven't really had a video conversation available for you guys. So, you know, for those that like to listen or watch instead of read, or just may not be connected to that community yet, hopefully yet, we welcome you to join us. I welcome Kevin to the podcast tonight to talk about all of his work and really dive into this great game. And so, Kevin, thank you for joining me here.
You're welcome, Travis. Thanks for having me, man.
My pleasure. I mean, we've had a great time. You know, Michael Dance over in Pittsburgh has been organizing some really great in-person events to try to really kind of bring the game out. We do a lot of stuff online, which is great, you know, for me as a parent and busy, you know, being able to just hop online and play a game at night after the kids are in bed from with anybody, you know, within a decent time zone has been great. But, you know, Michael's work in trying to really kind of get people in person and kind of moving between Pittsburgh and Akron has been awesome. And Kevin, you connected with Michael a couple of years ago, and you've been instrumental, you know, in kind of helping organize and make those great events with him. And I've flown down a couple of times and we've played, you know, you've kind of knocked me out of top position. We've been in the finals both times together, and you've kind of thoroughly trounced me in those. And so, so I bow to your experience here, you know, as we go through, and it's very apparent what you've done with the Gauntlet. So talk to us a little bit about what the Gauntlet is, where the idea came from, and kind of how, what your goal with it has been.
Mm-hmm. So Travis, I started really playing BattleTech in the mid 90s, with a group of my friends. We were all in school, but we were kids. We didn't have money. We didn't have resources to buy boxes of cards and stuff like that. So we learned very little. We played the game for a couple of years very casually and then just kind of left it. We just shelved it. And I had my cards in a box for 20 plus years. When the pandemic hit, and you kind of just take stock of your life in that moment. And I unearthed this box of, you know, 800 cards 25 plus years later or whatever it was. And I was like, you know, I never really deeply explored the game, like as an adult, in some scientific manner, with the knowledge of what the whole scene had looked like in the late 90s, because we weren't really tapped into what Worlds tournaments were, what local tournaments there were. We just kind of played together at my school. And so fast forward to 2020, and I find the Facebook group. I get access to listings of the world's decks from 97 through 2000. And I kind of was intrigued, curious, and the old fire kind of rekindled to really figure out like how to play the game. And I think the question that kind of has always motivated me like was, you know, what's the best deck? You know, what's the deck that can beat all the other decks, the fastest deck? You know, three hands, four hands, you win the game. Nobody can stop you. So that question kind of prompted me to start playing around with the decks that were, you know, of legend. You know, 20 plus years ago, these were the decks that everybody was playing. And then the game kind of disappeared. So I started playing around with those decks, and I started, like, you know, figuring what cards would I need and that kind of thing. Through the Facebook group, I was able to install Lackey. And I think that was a pretty big step in being able to do stuff. And to anybody who's watching this and hasn't installed Lackey, so convenient. You don't have to shuffle cards. You don't have to flip cards. All the images are high res. It's really convenient to just load up on your computer and not only look at cards, but play with other people across the globe. And we did that. I think your first league was the first time I had played with people in 25 years. I think that was in like 2020 or 2021. I think that was
22. Actually, I think it was the 22? Summer of 22. Yeah.
Okay. I remember there was like a bracket, and there was like a beginner's bracket kind of thing.
Yeah, we split it into experience groups, and so definitely for those listening that might be intimidated, you're not going to be playing against me or Kevin, on your first round. Put you with the other rookies and let you kind of grind there. There's no clubbing baby seals, mm-hmm. and in the tournament there. But
I think one of the things that Michael Dance brings to the table is energy of really trying to encourage new players to explore mm-hmm. the game, because it's such a fascinating game. And I grew up playing competitive chess. Like, I was in those tournaments that are in like Searching for Bobby Fischer movies and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And so I've always been really into gaming and the tactics of it and the strategy of it and all the decisions, the what if they do this, I do this, they do this, I do this kind of thinking. Michael Dance is all about that too, but he organizes events that everybody can be a part of, particularly with like his draft events. He tries to organize it so that everybody has some chance to play, to feel like they're playing competitively, and to have a chance to do well. And we've seen a great connection through that. So I think your point about, it's not about clubbing baby seals. It's really about just enjoying the nuance and the depth that the game has to offer.
Yeah, it's providing the access points is critical, for growing the community. We kind of, I do my regular leagues online and my cause the in-person events, but it takes dozens, to be generous, sometimes hundreds of hours of recruiting, right, to find those those people and kind of getting out there and sharing on Facebook kind of what we're doing and fun mm-hmm. card images to kind of raise awareness, let people know that, hey, there are people playing this game. My selling point is always, that, game of BattleTech trading card game takes maybe 30, 40 minutes, mm-hmm. at the most. Maybe if you're slow and you're still kind of learning the mechanics, it might take an hour, if you're thinking more, but, BattleTech, on the tabletop is a long game, and it takes hours and it takes a lot of setup. You got to go somewhere. You got to find other people. You set up the table. You got to deal with the sheets, which is great kind of in its own, but for people who are working a lot or have families that really love BattleTech and the BattleTech setting, it's very difficult to get that. Like, I've played in person maybe twice in the last 2 years, mm-hmm. And so whereas I can play BattleTech almost anytime I want, I just hop on the Discord server and let people know I'm available, and if they're not available that night, we can schedule one later in the week. But and you mentioned Lackey, the software is incredibly easy. It's, I always say it's not sexy, but it's extremely functional, and so I know when I started, there are some people that would talk about Tabletop Simulator, and then there's Lackey, and kind of, I just saw people were playing on Lackey, so I picked it up, and rather than try to kind of build on both communities, I was like, well, this is a very effective software. Again, if you're used to playing like Magic Arena or something, I think it's called, or something online, it's not going to be that smooth, but mm-hmm. it's everything you need to play a solid game and to play it quickly and efficiently. And so, but getting new players, you just get there, and I think removing the intimidation factor, mm-hmm. is important. Kind of, building a community that's excited about new players and takes that time is very good. And Michael does an amazing job doing that in person and crafting events that are fun to attend, and competitive, and with the draft cube, certainly, for me, and we talked a little bit before we started recording, I consider myself a very tactical player, not so much a strategic player, because I just don't have the time and capacity to really theory craft and deck build, and what I really enjoy about the game is just being in the moment and the decisions. It is very chess-like, that's your background. I'm sure that kind of plays into why you like this game. And, for those that aren't aware, this is, I think, Richard Garfield's second or third game after Magic the Gathering that he did. I think, Wyvern might have been in there. I'm not sure of the specific timelines, but, the elements are there. So you're getting someone who designed Magic the Gathering, the biggest card game out there, and you're adding a couple years worth of experience, you know, and kind of game design to it to bring to BattleTech. And so, and you can tell that, it's a very unique game in terms of the decision making on the table. It's fun. But again, I can enjoy BattleTech. I can put out, my Phoenix Hawk and put my Shinyadama on my Phoenix Hawk, and I can go attack somebody's, resources or their other mechs or, and so for me, I get to enjoy that setting that I grew up with as a kid. And that's kind of the selling point is like, you can play and you can play a tournament, you can play a tournament, you can do a match, in, an hour and a half. It's great. Whereas if you go to Alpha Strike tournament, you're talking about, a full day, not everyone has that full day. Plus, you don't have the ability to drive. So yeah, it's a great opportunity. And so it's been fun kind of trying to build that community, frustrating at times and kind of getting the traction and convincing people. But I like what, Michael's doing. I really appreciate the work that you've been doing in terms of kind of digging into and understanding the game. Because again, when I started Renegade HPG, it was inspired by my time playing X-Wing Miniatures, and they had great podcasts for that, where I would just listen to in the car driving and just listen to the game. And I would say that game is the best I've been at a game is X-Wing. Okay. And it was 100% due to being able to listen to those podcasts. And so, and your work is right in line with what those podcasts did and what they did for my play and my enjoyment of that game. And so that's why I'm excited to kind of dive in. But so the gauntlet is breaking down deck archetypes, ranking them against each other. Let's dive into it, because there's, let's talk about that ranking. Let's talk about the archetypes. Mm-hmm. What is your process for finding the best deck?
I started with those world decks and I played them against each other. And the first time I would draw through a deck, I had no idea what I was doing. And it wasn't that I was immediately recording results and such. I was just trying to figure out what was going on with the deck. So you pull some old Davian pilot deck from 1998 and you have no idea how Solaris Contacts works to put out a very expensive, strong pilot that's going to stick around for multiple turns and kill a bunch of their units. But you start to figure that out after looking at decks and asking yourself every time you draw two more cards, like, what's the best thing that I can do with these seven cards in my hand right now? And you start to understand, oh, Solaris Contacts does put out these big pilots, or Strategic Bombardment does kill their resources and things like that. And so by picking a deck and then picking a second deck and playing them against each other enough times, I was able to figure out, okay, this deck usually wins against that deck. And that's what I've done over and over and over and over again. And the gauntlet is up to 113 decks now that I've played against every other deck in that list. And I keep track of which deck seems to have the advantage over the other deck. I usually play the two decks in a best of three matchup. Sometimes it takes four games maybe to figure out which deck has an advantage over the other deck consistently. Sometimes it takes just two games and deck A just absolutely trashes deck B. And sometimes I'm not sure. Sometimes I have no idea. And so when those two decks face against each other in a best of three matchup, I will conclude after three or four games, hopefully less, that means less time, but which one is the deck that's going to win and which one is the deck that's going to lose, or if there's a tie. And I keep track of those results. And so the 113 decks that have been listed through the gauntlet now have a wins, loss, ties record from all of those matchups where I'm playing those two decks against each other. And the number one deck in the gauntlet has the best record. And the 115th deck in the gauntlet has the worst record, the most losses, the least wins. And by doing that, I now can just make up any deck I want. Deck 114, I can build it in Lackey. I can load it up and I can move it from 113 all the way up to deck one and see how it does against all the decks that exist and find out kind of where it breaks down, what archetypes it's strong against, what archetypes it's weak against, what I need to change about the deck because the cards aren't arriving when I need them or my combos aren't clicking effectively or something like that. And as a tool, it's great for testing a new deck. As a tool, it's great for knowing two decks that you could pick off the shelf and they'll be a really good matchup. I know one of the things that Michael Dance and I really enjoy doing is pulling two decks from that list and the results that I have mapped out in the spreadsheet and having a really competitive match. Sometimes hard, two great decks from 1998, and they're totally a mismatch. One deck just absolutely runs right through the other deck, like there's nothing to it. And these could be, a fourth place Davian Pilot deck that's just an absolute masterpiece of a deck, Barry Young's deck, and play that against, the SRMA, Sandhurst Royal Military Academy decks that took first and second in 1998. Those Sandhurst Royal Military Academy decks will just trounce the Barry Young deck, and you would think the Barry Young deck is garbage, but it's not. It's a great deck. It's a fantastic deck. They just don't match up well against each other. And so Michael Dance and I have routinely picked decks that I know are good matchups against each other because I've played them, and it's a lot of back and forth. The missions kind of cancel each other off. One has sturdy units, the other has fast units that can dash past those sturdy units. Whatever the way the matchup is, it's a tool the gauntlet is for knowing what your deck needs to improve on if you play it through the gauntlet, for knowing how your deck ranks in terms of strength, in terms of figuring out what changes you want to make to your deck. And for me, it's been the tool by which I've really learned how to play the game. All the nuance of it, what all the cards do, what really efficient play looks like. And I had seen that from playing people prior, but when I played Chad Edwards about 20 times, and I think it was May of 2021. And when I played against him, it was just immediately like obvious that this guy was playing at like a competitive level and with a sense of urgency and efficiency that I had never seen before. And that's when I really started taking the game, not seriously, but really thinking about the game in a structured, focused sort of, I want to get to the win. What do I need to do on turn one, turn two, turn three, turn four kind of thing?
Yeah, and Chad, for those listening, it was World Champion 20 or 2000 or 99. Which one was
2000,
it?
yep.
2000. Yeah.
I think he was
Yeah.
second in 99 and like ninth, I think, in 98 or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, Chad was a great resource while he was there, and it was, say, I had the same experience. I was like, Chad was thinking about the game differently, and for me, my entire life, especially adult life, has been rooted in competition. I was a competitive athlete. I'm a professional coach. That's how I pay the bills. And so, the idea of just competing to kind of bring out the best in yourself is second nature for me. And so, being in there, and like for me, when I started, I was just getting curb stomped, by people, and then just figuring out and just watching and listening. And I always tell rookies, I was like, you got the best way to learn is just net deck, grab a deck that is solid, that somebody who knows the game has built, and it's a good deck, and it has, elements you like, whether you like pilots or fast units or whatever it might be, and play that deck, and then just, learn and get beat and watch other people, and so, and that's how you're going to understand the game, and for me, it was like, about, 6 to 9 months or so of getting my ass kicked, and then another year and a half of kind of, middle of the road, to where the point where like, okay, I know, if we're playing equal decks, then chances are I can beat most people, more than 50% of the time. And so, and that's that the process. But yeah, seeing, you encounter those players and just like, all right, Chad's thinking about things differently, and especially when you see cards that you didn't even think about, that are suddenly popping out, like, oh shit, didn't expect that, and so, oh, what's doing that?
I
What's up
still
with these
remember those.
Saladins everywhere? Chad introduced me to the Saladin. It was a very rough introduction, but
The
well,
rough unit to
yeah,
play against.
it is. It is. I got some flashbacks when I played you in December. So, but yeah. So,
What you said about the playing, I think, is so important. And I think it's so important for new players to hear and for everybody to hear, I think, because you can theorize about the cards and you can argue about the subtle meaning of this versus that. And I'm not on Discord, so I'm not sure what the conclusion of the conversation has been, but there's a debate I think going on right now about if you can synergize maneuvering ace with hand to hand. I put a deck through the gauntlet that I assumed that that was an acceptable play. And whatever the community's decision eventually is, I'm okay with that. I'm not married to them being able to synergize or them being unable to synergize. But that to new players, worrying about the theory and the does it work and does it synergize, like just get out there and play. Like
Yeah, it
logging
doesn't
the
matter.
hours of playing is really how you get good at it. And when you've seen somebody pull a Solaris contacts, you know there's a pilot coming soon. You know they're going to tap that to put a pilot out, and you try to kill that Solaris contact before they put a pilot out. And you learn that over and over and over again with the cards of the game, that
Yeah.
playing and logging those hours is the way to really understand how to play at the most competitive levels, but at all levels, I think.
Oh, 100%. And I mean, I think I'm a great example of that because I play a lot. I'm pretty sure I play more competitive Battletech than anybody out there right now, because I enter every event that's out there, all of my own, all of everybody else's, because I want to learn. And I spend almost no time at home building decks. And we've got the two events I've traveled down to, Pittsburgh and Akron with, both of which I got into the finals with you. You outnumber me by exponential amounts in terms of time, put in the game, and so, and that was not for me worrying about how do these cards interact. And honestly, I listen to those conversations and usually I tune them out. I'll have an opinion here or there, but that's not what I'm interested in. I'm not the guy that wants to be the referee at the tournaments. I'm not the kind, the rules guy. I'm more of the just, well, tell me what the ruling is and I'll work with it. Oh, so you want to do this with, that rule. Okay, great. Just as long as I know beforehand and it's not changing in the middle, we're good. And those synergies, yeah, I'm just like, I'd be in a game and I'd, go and I'm like, I don't know what, and the community's friendly too. It's not like we don't have assholes and rules lawyers in the community, and so everyone there is just like, well, do you know what happens? I don't know what happens. Well, let's post it on Facebook or the Discord. And if someone's online and happens to respond quick, great. Otherwise, we'll just roll a die and make a decision and move on. And that's great, but to kind of get back to the point is, I'm up there in the community. Granted, it's a very, very small pond, right? And we're, medium-sized fish in a pond of really small people, but I'm not worried about that stuff and I'm doing all right. And more importantly, I'm having fun with it,
I
mainly
think,
because I'm not worried about that shit. I'm just like, okay, well, that synergy doesn't work. All right, well, let's try something else. I'll net deck something else, from the gauntlet that, Michael has spent hundreds of hours doing. I'm gonna steal his idea. I'm gonna go have fun and play my tactical game and he can kind of, handle the strategic element. And so yeah, and new players, I think they just, get intimidated by that. But the biggest thing is just play. Just play.
I
And
agree. I
people
think that.
will correct you as you go. You'll learn
I
the
think.
game better by playing it with somebody who knows the rules and helping you than reading that rule book 10 times.
And I know, like you, Michael Dance, community outreach and community growth for a game that's 20 plus years out of print, like that seems to be like the ultimate achievement, I think, to get more people involved. And more people involved means more ideas, new ideas. I know. We've seen a lot of work with Chester and the new cards that he and Michael Cohen have come up with for BT Tactics 2. I think Mitch Grant's done a bunch of stuff with that through the Facebook group. Like new people getting involved is how new ideas emerge. Jonathan Murphy showed up to the last Constructed Akron event and had a box of like decks that he showed me, and like half of them were from the Gauntlet. And I was touched. I was like heartfelt touch. Like that this guy was using like what I had spent hours figuring out to then build on that. And he had decks in there that I had no idea what they were. Wrassle handgun. I don't know what that deck is. And it's cool to see like other people coming up with new stuff. And that's not to knock theorizing. Like there are people who love like the subtlety of the wording and the exact meaning of what each action does in the game. And I think that's fair too. But when it comes down to playing the game, like you got to play, you got to play, and you got to play, and you got to play, kind of thing. So that's what I've done with the Gauntlet over and over and over again. Like you said, a lot of hours. Yeah, a lot of hours.
Well, let's talk about break down archetypes for us. And so, can you kind of list out either all the archetypes if it's not too much, or what are kind of the main archetypes people should be, looking at considering that are viable and fun to play with? And then we can kind of start breaking down how, they interact within that gauntlet.
Sure. Let me I'm gonna pull it up so you won't see it. You'll still see my face, right?
And let me hop into the screen share, and so we can, as we talk about specific cards, I can bring them up so people can look, check it out.
You're gonna do that through Lackey?
Yeah, I'll do that through Lackey. So for
So
those
let's see.
that aren't familiar with the game, this is Lackey. It's a very, very easy software. It's just, you just download it and you'll undo a zip file and it's good to go. So it's not even like installable, executable
Let's
file,
see
but
here. So I'm looking at the gauntlet on the same screen as I'm looking at you. It's a little bit confusing because there's so much information, but let's get that out of the way. Okay. So I'm just going to pick somewhere in the mid of this list. There's 113 decks on here, starting somewhere in the late high 50s, low 60s is where some of the world's decks from 97, 98, 99 start to show up. And I'm just going to kind of scroll through those. I'm going to scroll through the top 60 or so decks that are in here because that's where the world's competitive decks kind of show up in the gauntlet, at least in my estimate.
yeah.
And the first one that I see that shows up is actually at 78. I made no modifications to this deck. It is Shuya Kao's 1997 deck. He built what's called a swarm or Innersphere swarm deck. I like to call it a 2/7 swarm because that's the terms that Chad Edwards kind of used to describe it. And this deck, it played with very few of the expansions, so it had very limited access to the
Kevin,
most
what was the
recent
deck
cards.
in year? It might be in my
1997, it would have been it was the third place deck.
I
So
only
I
have the
see
top
first
two
and
for that
second.
year.
Yep, I see first and second. Can I? See, I might be able to share with you. Can I share with you?
Yep.
Okay. Can you see my lackey?
Not yet. There it is. Okay.
All right. I'm going to scroll through a bunch of decks.
All right,
Anybody
we're
who's paying
good.
attention is going to get a list of all these decks here. I need to go to Davian. All right, Davian. There it is. I think the first time I saw, I think it was Mark Roberts was sharing like some deck list. And like I watched the video and I tried to zoom in on all the decks. So anybody that wants to zoom in all these lists of decks and try to figure out what they are, Mark Roberts is like a genius of keeping track of the history of this game. He's a phenomenal resource to have for the history of it. And for like the card interpretation and play, I think. Kudos, Mark. I got a lot of information about decks and deck building from him because of his records. Yik's deck is on screen now, I think.
Excellent.
So this deck, I've been calling it a 2/7 swarm because, as Chad Edwards described, you want a lot of two cost units that can all take 7 hit points worth of damage. The idea is to pump the board full of units that are going to stick around for a long time and to overrun with a swarm your opponent's deck. Too many units, they can't block all of them. Some of them get through, they're going to damage the other opponent's stockpile and win by numbers. I think John Murphy said this is like a numbers deck or an efficient numbers deck. It's like the basics of the game, two deployments per turn. And Chad's rule was put out 2 units per turn every turn. You just keep dumping units on the board once you get to 3 or 4 resources. You put out an assembly and you put out a mongoose. And then you put out a tactics and you put out a centurion, which is 2 cost. And then you put down another resource and you put down another unit. And then by turn 3 or 4, you're putting out 2 units per turn. Every turn, your opponent cannot keep up with that. 2/7 swarms basically take advantage of the fact that it's better to have a lot of cheap units on the board than a couple of big units on
Got it.
the board. And Yik's deck was the first one that figured that out. Shuya Kao took third in 97. I think he took second in 1998 with a totally different style deck. But he was always present in like the top 5 to 10. Phenomenal player, really great at figuring stuff out. And that's probably the first deck I would try to give a beginner that's a world-class deck that would show them kind of the pace of world's competitive decks because it's simply deploy resources, deploy units, attack, attack, again and again. And you can alternate your attacks to include a bunch of units if you want to kill one of their units off when they try to block. You can do it in single units. The first time I played Chad, he was playing a 2/7 swarm he had tons of experience with. He attacked with each unit alone, and I asked him, "What are you doing? You're attacking with each unit alone." And he said, "Well, first off, if they're playing heavy fog, that means they can only cancel one of my units' attacks. And if I
Can you
attack,
highlight heavy fog for us so we can see it
sure.
on the screen? Yeah.
There you go. I'll
Perfect.
drag this up a little bit so you can see it. There you go. So, heavy fog is a defensive mission. You play it when you're attacked, and every unit in the group that's attacking gets -2 attack. So it dissuades your opponent from attacking with multiple units because every loses 2 attack. If you attack with just one unit, that one unit loses 2 attack. If you attack with 4 units and your opponent plays heavy fog, all 4 units lose 2 attack, or 8 total attack is lost.
Right. And since there's no limit to the number of missions, you can do a turn. You can just, there's no reason not to attack individually.
Exactly. Yep. And so there's all different kinds of ways to play it. It really is like a nuts and bolts deck of Battletech. There's no super fancy cards in here. It runs a couple of missions like Overrun, a couple of Fanatical Leaders, which are great for groups because it adds cumulative bonus for having multiple units together. Heavy Fog is a great defensive mission. And then the 1997 Luck of the Fox was a decent mission. I don't think it would make a tournament speed deck at this
Right.
point, but 1997, those were the best you or best missions that Yik thought to include against what existed in those days. And I think if you count it up, he had 30 or 32 units, 6, 12, 16, 22, 26, 32. 32 units, none of them cost more than 3. The Wolfhound at 3 cost was his most expensive unit. And that idea of spamming the board with as many units as possible, taking advantage of having more units than the opponent, it's a great place to start for new players because it's a very easy deck to play, deploy units, deploy resources, and then it's very good at teaching you what are appropriate attack and attack pairs and attack combos based on what they have on the board. So it really teaches you about battle strategy and forcing your opponent into mismatched battles because you've got the advantage in numbers.
Perfect.
If we go a couple of years into the future, Mike Bodie and Chad Edwards had played a bunch of these together. I'll pull up Mike Bodie's deck from 2000 if people can see the card listing there. If not, I'll scroll through real quick. Let's sort this by card type. So resources, assembly and taxes is a very common resource breakdown for these types of decks because it covers all the asset buyouts that units need. He used several big pilots because by this point, a couple years after Shia Kahl's deck, now those big pilots are activated for free deployment and cost via Solaris Contacts, one of the more important games in or cards in the development of the game probably. Because you tap it and then you just get to put for free one of those 5 or 6 cost pilots like Tai, Champion of Solaris, right into the board.
Right.
He still used the same structure of 6/1 cost Wolfhounds, 6/3 cost Wolfhounds, 6/2 cost Hatchetmen, 6/2 cost Centurions. The cost here being 1, 2, maybe 3 cost, that 2 cost being the central number there where you have a lot of units, cheap. Sturdy, you're going to survive battle, and your opponent's not going to be able to keep up with you. That's a great place to start for any beginners. And then we can get into all other kinds of more advanced archetypes that you'd like. When we talk about a different one?
Yep, let's do a different archetype.
Okay, I will stop sharing here for a second. Let's stop sharing. That work?
Yep.
Okay. So 2/7 swarms are a great place to start if you've not played the game before. They're a great place to start if you're a competitive player. At Worlds 25, I think Jason was my first opponent, and he played. It might have been Mike Bodie's deck or very similar to it, a 2/7 swarm. And you have to be on your toes to be able to withstand the kind of barrage of all those units. If I scroll up a little bit, another deck type that a lot of players would probably find comfort playing with. There aren't too many intricate combos or unique subtleties to the cards. So I can share this one. Let's go back to that and share. And let me know, Travis, if that's showing up there.
Yeah, usually it takes a second. There it is. We see it.
Okay. All right. And I'll show on here. This is the 1999 version of Peter Sundholm's Boom Wolf deck. And so, opposite this 2/7 Inner Sphere Davian Pilot Swarm archetype, you have a clan fast dashing wolf deck that is able to get fast units out that are instantly active in the patrol region, like these Phantom A's and Phantom B's and the Dasher Prime, ubiquitous to almost any one of these types of decks. Coupled with missions like Superior Navigation, which does an extra 4 damage, which enables those fast dashing units that are immediately active and difficult to block to attack resources or to attack the stockpile and do a lot of damage very quickly and prevent your opponent from kind of developing their deck. So that was popular. Peter Sundholm won Worlds in 97 using this style of deck. I think he took third in 98 and then, or and then I think Dave Hymas, his friend, I think took third in 99 or something like that. So it was a very
Yeah.
competitive deck style back in the day. It uses a lot of clan fasts. This one places for me right around 50, 49 or 50 on the gauntlet. I'm going to show you Michael Dance's deck that he came up with on screen. And his is kind of a modern take on that.
Okay.
So I've just switched over to that deck and I'll scroll through the cards quickly. Michael Dance's deck again uses the Dasher Primes at 2 cost, but he kind of recognized, Michael did, that the cost of the units in Boom Wolf at this stage of the game and the development and understanding the game, that that cost was a little bit prohibitive. 4 and 5 cost units are tough to bring out at a tournament speed deck. So he included the Jenner 2Cs, he included the Piranhas from the MechWarrior expansion, he included the Dasher Bees from the Counter-Strike expansion. He still included those missions that Peter came up with back in 1997, Superior Navigation and pushing the envelope there.
Yeah.
But Michael's deck has a little bit more of a modern twist to it because he included a lot of armor cards for their ability to make the units more durable. But additionally, for if you read the text on that card there, it says playing extra armor plating does not count as a deployment if revealed the turn you play it. So it doesn't cost against you to play a deployment. You can still play 2 cards that turn. And it then says, draw a card when you reveal extra armor plating. So it, in fact, replaces itself in your hand and essentially is a 0 cost, free deploy, draw causing card, which keeps Michael's deck continually picking up more units, continually picking up more mission cards. And those units are the really fast dashing ones, the now sturdier because of the armor with the missions that do a lot of damage when you sneak them past your opponent's units. And that's another very common archetype that's very strong and I think also fairly simple for a new player to probably pick up, play with, and kind of understand, oh, okay, the strategy is to put out one of these units that does 3 damage. It's too fast to be blocked. I'm going to play a superior navigation on it. And with the additional 4 damage that superior navigation enables, I will now be able to do 7 and kill their assembly's resource, install their unit production. So
Yeah,
those are.
the Boom Wolf is the deck that I picked up as a novice and like just started learning the game with.
And Peter, you know, back in 97 had figured out that genius combo of a turn 2 Dasher Prime. You play an A on turn 1 and a T and a Dasher Prime on turn 2. The Dasher Prime's immediately active. You attack one of their resources. They've got 1 or 2 on the board. You play Superior Navigation, and now they have 0 or 1 resources. They're now like a turn behind practically on
Yeah.
turn 2. So those are two very good, I think, archetypes for new players to start with. The 2/7 swarms, usually Inner Sphere, and the clan fast dashing mission empowered decks. If I scroll further up the gauntlet, I'll stop sharing for a second here. If I scroll further up the gauntlet, and try to pick out a couple of archetypes, we get to, oh man, there's all kinds. Do you have any? Do you have any? There's all kinds. I could talk about a ton of them, man.
Let's do
There's
some
all
pilot
kinds.
stuff. You know, one
Okay.
of my goals in developing the game is to get pilots more
Sure.
presence. And so let's talk about how they are kind of in the original set.
Yep. So I'll pick a deck here and show it to you that I'm not sure who came up with it, but I know that Gustav had posted a deck that was very similar to it, Gustav Olsen. I'm going to browse here and find where is it? There it is. Big Pilots Many. There we go. So this is a Star League deck. It takes advantage of a card only available in the last expansion, Crusade, that enables you to put all of the Inner Spheres factions together, Merrick and Karita and Davian and Steiner, all right next to each other. And this deck is a good pilot deck to kind of look at because it plays Solaris Contacts, which is almost essential for all pilot decks, but it's allowed to use a bunch of different pilots. So it has Dan Allard in it, who's a great pilot deck addition. He essentially lets you reuse another pilot that you've got a second time that turn. It's got the usual suspects like Kai, Champion of Solaris, Kyle and Leo, and Prince Victor Steiner Davian that we saw in the modern versions of Yik's deck and the 2/7 Swarms. It has pilots from Lao like Aris Sung there, and it uses missions that kind of couple well with pilots, which is also helpful. Pilots that do a lot of damage, Forged Mission Orders is great for untapping a blocker and sending all that damage through to the stockpile or a resource. Force of Will is a great pilot mission that came out in Crusade that does +4 attack, does prevent one damage to that unit, but it only works for piloted units. And missions like those are very helpful. A command card that's very helpful to use with pilots as well is called Single Combat. A MechWarrior expansion card, Single Combat, allows you to use the pilot and unit that it's piloting. And then while it's tapped, to then tap Single Combat and force battle with your opponent, choosing one of their units to now battle your piloted unit and thus get a second use out of that pilot that turn.
Right.
Single Combat's a great card to use alongside pilots, as is another MechWarrior card, Wolfgang Hansen. He untaps one of your piloted units, and that is, again, a great benefit to have. If you could use a card like Kai, Champion of Solaris, twice in the same turn, that's a massive advantage against your opponent. So pilot decks can have some missions that really synergize well, Single Combat, a command card that really synergizes well. Solaris Contacts, again, is present in probably every pilot deck that I try to play competitively, certainly every Inner Sphere pilot deck. Another pilot deck, I'll pull up a second one here that I came up with myself and is pretty high on the gauntlet. I think this one's 12 or 13. It's somewhere around there. The rankings are always shifting slightly after each new deck comes in. But this one uses a lot of pilots. It uses 5 of the MechWarrior expansion Sharpshooter, which is great for Alpha Strike. And in addition to that, it uses the main names that we've seen now several times. Prince Victor Steiner Davian, Kai Allard, Leo, Kai Champa Solaris, Dan Allard. There's Wolfgang Hansen right there. The thing about this deck that really makes it competitive is that it uses the Sharpshooter, which is one of the better, probably the most competitive non-unique pilot that there is, because it enables you to use Alpha Strike to get 2 additional attack from that Alpha Strike use and to not deplete, which I think is a very, very big bonus. And so that Sharpshooter is then coupled with, in this deck, 5 Wolf Traps that all Alpha Strike for +2, which is a great Alpha Strike, and 6 Centurions, which also Alpha Strike for +2. So when you pick pilots and you want to play a pilot deck, having Solaris Contacts, having those missions is very important, but having units that synergize with your pilot's abilities is also very important, whether it's Alpha Strike, whether it's Overheat. There's Red Line pilot from MechWarrior that synergizes great with Overheaters, or you have pilots that all do +3 attack and all your units do 4 attack. So then you have 7 total damage and you can kill resources or kill units very easily. I think Mark Roberts was the first one to write an article on the importance of being able to do 7 damage, however, with a mission or a unit or a pilot or something. So with pilot decks, Solaris Contacts is almost required to be competitive. Pick missions that are going to go well with your pilots, pick command cards like Single Combat and Wolfgang Hansen that are going to go well with your pilots, and pick units that are going to go well with your pilots' abilities. Those are all, I think, really important. And pilot decks are great. Like, I think this one's ranked 12th or 13th on the gauntlet. It does use the Star League, which brings up the asterisk of, is the Star League broken, which we can talk about later on. But pilot decks are great. They're all the way up to about the top 10 or so, and they're all littered through there depending on whether you're running, you know, a Karita deck, or you're running a Davian deck, or you're running some kind of combination thanks to an alliance like this Star League deck. Pilots are still totally alive, I think, in the game.
And to take a step back into your comment about the seven damage, the reason for newer people listening, the reason seven damage is important because most, probably over 90% of the cards in the game that you would want to attack, seven damage will kill. You know, and it might be even 95% of the cards that you'd want to attack in the game, seven damage will kill. And for a lot of them, it's exactly seven. It's not less. And so hitting that seven number shows up with a lot of units, the 2/7 swarms particular. So if you want to start hunting units, you know, being able to do seven damage with a deck like Boom Wolf, it's going to be important to kind of hunt down those 2/7 swarms. And also all the basic supports are going to be seven. And so that's why that number is important. And that's a big thing for a new player to realize that importance of the number seven, you know, for your ability.
And kudos to Mark for highlighting that idea. I think Peter Tremko, one of the main names on the Facebook group, talked about Mark kind of being the guy who figured that out or wrote an article about it. And that taught Peter Tremko a lot of stuff too.
Yeah, and even, you know, look at Peter Sundholm's original deck. You know, you were talking about the Dasha Prime plus Superior Navigation. That's 3 + 4. That's 7. Yep. So, you know, that number has been present from the beginning.
Yep. So that's like a great little intro on pilots. As I go up the gauntlet, there's a number of other decks that work and a number of other archetypes that work. You have decks that make use of, do you mind if I share again?
Not again, or not at all.
I'll load that up and hit share. Let's see. Let me bring up a deck here. You have a number of decks that work by making use of the card Double Overtime, which I think was a promo card that was introduced around the time of Commander's Edition. Mm-hmm. And let me get to the Steiner section here. There we go. So this deck on screen, we've talked single combat real quickly, but it makes use of, there's the card right there. I have an older, I think, version of Lackey, an older plugin. So this card looks a little bit different because I think it's one of Michael and Chester's modified cards. The idea of Double Overtime, though, is you reveal one of the units under construction, and then you double the number of construction counters on that card. This makes it possible to play 9, 10, 11, 12 cost units at tournament speed to be competitive playing those. So this deck uses 4 gunslingers, which are 10 cost, and 6 thunderhawks, which are 12 cost, which you normally would never be able to get out at a tournament speed game, except that if you can get 6 counters on that and then play a double overtime, now it's activated and it's coming out next turn into your patrol region to do some serious damage on your opponents at 8 attack with an overheat and long range of 3 and so on. So there are decks that you can use massive units for, thanks to the card Double Overtime. I think that's one that really missed mention in most of the world's scenes because it didn't come out till Commander's Edition. Another tournament-style deck that showed up just very briefly because it kind of became viable near the end of the world's events is Elementals. So this deck, I think, is 14th or 13th or 11th, somewhere in that range on the gauntlet. And, that's not the right one. There we go. That's the right one there. This one makes use of elementals from the Arsenal expansion. Blitzkrieg elemental point, Skirmisher elemental point, and a lot of low-cost, fast clan units like Dasher Prime again, Hankyu Prime, Fire Falcon B. By putting those pairs together, elementals with a fast clan unit, both then move together as fast, and they do at least 7 or so damage, like you mentioned Peter's deck did, except now all of the units are 2 cost and 3 cost and 1 cost for the elementals, which is more similar to Michael Dance's Boom Bear deck. By reducing the cost of the units from Peter Sundholm's 1997 version to a more modern low cost, Michael Dance with Boom Bear and these elemental type decks can get out more units like Shuya Kao's cheap 2/7 swarm deck could back in 1997, and then overrun your opponent with all those units again. Elementals is a great strategy. I think Ben in Akron has made great use of the elementals. He's been a player that's emerged over the last couple of tournaments playing elementals. He loves playing elementals, and it's still a very viable and modern strategy to play. tournament decks ranking, or gauntlet decks ranking in the 40s and the 30s and the 20s. I think this one, the one that you're looking at, ranks 13 or 12 again. So elementals are great. Large units with double overtime are great. The C3 decks are definitely possible as well. I'll load up a C3 deck here. My best effort at the Evil Owens deck is not entirely C3 units, but if I sort this right, then everyone can see the units at the top. The Owens from the MechWarrior expansion, when coupled with the Owens Revised from the Commander's Edition, some people accept that that's playable. Some people try to bicker and say that's not playable. If you accept that those two are playable together in the same deck, then C3 decks are very competitive at the modern scene. This particular deck runs a lot of fast units, some missions, just like Peter Sumholm's deck, that are tailored to those units, to those C3 units. And again, two cost, there's a pattern to this. The modern game really enjoys you playing 2 and 3 cost units and rarely likes to deviate into the 4, 5, and 6 costers. They're just tougher to play. And they all go back to Yip's 1997 deck, where he figured out it's a better strategy to have more units that are cheaper than fewer units.
Ultimately, I think that plays into what Michael Cohen calls the original sin of the game, the five. So all the units, when you're building a card and costing a card, all the different abilities have a certain cost, you know, and they add those costs up and then they subtract 5. And so a unit with 7 points worth of value costs 2. So it's 7 minus 2. Well, if you think about that and you extract that out, you know, that means that if you play 2 2-cost units, you're getting 10 points worth of free value, whereas if you play a single 4-cost unit, you're only getting 5 points of free value. And so that there is a structural thing with the game that has kind of pushed it into that realm. And, you know, I think with both of the developers, you know, mainly active between myself and Michael, and kind of trying to expand, you know, the options by kind of tweaking that a little bit, either with different command cards like a double overtime that kind of open up play options, you know, or just kind of recosting, or just simply, you know, banning cards, you know, the way like a Magic the Gathering does as it evolves. You know, there's just cards that are like, all right, this is too restrictive on design space. Let's drop it out so we can start to explore other things. But,
Where would you like to go from here? Do you want to go into the most modern? What would you like to talk about?
I have a fun question that I wanted to ask from the beginning. Have you ever gone back to like a 1997, like a Peter Sunholm's Boom Wolf deck, and tried to build a deck that's better with the cards available at the time? So say, okay, well, if I was in 1997, I only had, you know, unlimited Counter-Strike to build from, could I beat Peter Sunholm with what I know now?
So that's a great question, and the answer is no.
No, you haven't tried, or no, you couldn't beat the.
I don't want to assume that I could. I haven't tried. There are several cards in the game that are so pivotal, I think, to play now that they didn't have access. That deck, Shuyakao's deck, I forced myself, like with one hand on top of the other as I'm clicking on the mouse, to play with his original deck on Altered, which has no think tanks in it. So you can't pick an asset that's not in your deck and get that asset, which means it's susceptible to all kinds of deck lockdowns, like arms reduction, which makes your deck include P or pay extensive amounts or not be able to build much, or Coordinator Theodore Carita from Arsenal, where you are locked down and can barely deploy anything if you don't have logistics. Think tank gets around those. Shuyakao didn't include Think Tank in his deck. He didn't have access to War Funds because the Arsenal expansion didn't exist yet. War Funds is probably the best card in the game. It smooths every deck's draw out. It makes it possible to grab a resource from your deck that you have one or two copies of, but it's pivotal to the victory that your deck is seeking. And Yik didn't have access to War Funds, and that was very frustrating. Sometimes I would play with Yik's deck while I was going through the gauntlet, and I would draw 5 tactics in a row, and I wouldn't get the assembly that I needed to build a Mongoose or a Centurion. So those kinds of limitations, now that we know what War Funds does, now that we know what Think Tank does, now that we know what Hasty Alliance does, those decks are the older decks that didn't have access to those cards. They suffer from the power creep that took place between the first and second expansion and Arsenal Commander's Edition and Crusade.
Right. Taking on that War Funds, what are some key cards in the life of the game, like War Funds, that not necessarily just like you have to have these cards, but understanding why that card is important for somebody to kind of elevate from a beginner to kind of intermediate plus, player.
Sure. War Funds for sure. I include as many War Funds in any deck as I can, 6 if possible, for smoothing out your draws so that you get all the assets that you need. If you need assembly, munitions, and tactics, you can have them all very quickly. If you get a good draw with War Funds, you don't need a good draw. You can get them pretty quickly without that. So War Funds is probably the most important one for a beginner to start working with and understanding why it's so powerful or so strong.
See if I can pull it up here.
Yeah.
Should I just do this?
Yeah, that's probably faster.
There we go. So War Funds.
There you go. Yep.
So basically allows you to kind of tutor your deck to find the resource that you need.
And any resource. It doesn't have to be just an ALMPT. It could be Solaris Contacts. It could be Black Market Connections. It could be whatever resource you need.
All right. War Funds, what's next?
I think Black Market Connections is probably the second one you'd have to look into, which allows you to scrap 2 cards from your hand and take a card from your scrap heap and put it back into your hand. And that is really, really helpful to be able to do, whether you have a mission that you want to use again, you have a unit that you need to help defend your command cards on the board, you have a command card that just got scrapped and you need it for part of your combo or something like that. Black Market Connections is the way to get back a card that you've lost. And because it's a resource, War Funds will find it in your deck. So if you tap and scrap that War Funds and go looking through your deck, you can pull the Black Market Connections and put it out as long as you can pay the 2 for the Black Market Connections. War Funds and Black Market Connections are probably number 1 and 2. Other cards that are like real helpful to modern decks, Hidden Reserves from the Mercenaries expansion is really important for any deck that's playing with logistics, especially if that deck is using units that deploy for free or generate another deployment. Hidden Reserves will draw extra cards, and drawing extra cards gives you more options in your hand. Drawing extra cards draws through your deck faster, which newer players might feel like that is hurting their deck. But if you are drawing through your deck faster, you're getting to your deck and opening those options up faster than your opponent is. And that can win the game easily. So Hidden Reserves is a very common deck. A very common card to include in any deck that is using logistics.
I think that tempo, understanding the tempo element is the big thing with Hidden Reserves. And that a lot of those decks that hit hard and fast, if you're able to hold off those decks and shut them down in the early rounds, they're going to lose, right? Mm-hmm. And those decks know that. And so, yes, Hidden Reserves is going to, it's going to take away your life by drawing from your deck because this is a life deck game. Those decks win or lose based on those first, 6-7 rounds, or so, and so if it's getting much beyond that, that deck's lost no matter what. So kicking those Hidden Reserves isn't going to matter. And it's the same thing. I have plenty of decks where I know, they're going to lose those first, few rounds to a faster deck. And I can tell usually early on, is this fast enough to kind of close me out before my momentum games, and and it helps play and just be very relaxed and understand that I can take 20 damage in the first several turns, because I know that if you can't get me to 30 damage, you're gonna lose. Basically once my deck is moving, then you're gonna be shut down. Hidden Reserves is interesting. So you're paying 1 in a deployment to get 2 extra cards.
You get to draw those 3, and that then you might draw the card that you need. I know Zvi Moshevitz, the famous Magic player, used this card in addition to he used a couple of mech hangers, and with that combination, by using Hidden Reserve to draw cards and then using Mech Hanger, he was able to sometimes play two Hidden Reserves in a turn, draw six cards, and then Mech Hanger allowed him to make additional deployments. So you're now drawing six cards in a turn and deploying four cards per turn. And it's essentially you're taking two turns or three turns when to your opponent's one. And that's obviously a massive tempo boost. So that combination has been used very successfully. I'm looking at your deck right there. It looks very familiar. You've got a lot of Lao contracts and a card that I'll ask you to highlight. Hasty Alliance is another modern card from the Crusade expansion that I think a lot of new players might not know much about. It never emerged at the Worlds tournament scene until the very end when there was not a lot written about the Worlds events. So it doesn't really exist in any Worlds caliber deck lists. But you played with this style of deck and took second place at Worlds 25. Gustav Olsen's deck is a legendary deck in terms of the strength of it, or his version of it, I should say, because I believe Mark, with his encyclopedic record on history, has referenced Ben the Blob Moffat as being the progenitor of this style of deck, I think, at the world scene at least. Hasty Alliance allows you to look through your deck and pick a unique card if you already have a unique card in play. And what this does is it makes uniques viable at a world speed or a competitive speed because you now can pull them in a certain order that you want, in a regular systematic fashion and with regularity, with consistency that uniques otherwise can't be played with. And this card is very powerful. It's for new players. I wouldn't suggest starting to play with a deck like this. I would say pick it up and try to play with it, and you'll learn like how to play with it. But it's not a simple deck to play like the 2/7 Swarms. Hasty Alliance is a very, very, very good card.
Yeah, and the other value of Hasty Alliance is that it makes those uniques cost two. So because it's telling you bring the card in, it's in play, you don't have to pay for it. The Hasty Alliance costs two. So I can use that two cost Hasty Alliance to go find my deck, a five or six cost unique, put that in play immediately. And so not only do I go get to pick which unique I need given the current board state, but it only costs two. So that's why I play a lot of it.
And for new players who haven't played much with the game and are just starting to look at what's out there in terms of competitive decks, Hasty Alliance uses the phrase, search your stockpile for any unique command card and put it into your command post. That phrase, put it wherever, into your command post, onto a unit. That phrase is repeated in several of the most powerful command cards in the game. Here in Hasty Alliance for uniques, Solaris Contacts for pilots. The MechWarrior expansion brought that one out, so that made pilots immediately more playable because you didn't have to spend a deployment. Merchant Cast. Merchant Cast is one of the most important clan archetypes, or big mech is what it's usually referred to as, because in Merchant Cast there it says, choose any resource card in your hand and put into play. When that light bulb clicked for me, I think it was another of Peter Tremko's posts on the Facebook groups. When he put that, or when he wrote about that, he said, you can now put any resource out for free. It doesn't cost a deployment. It doesn't cost what it says it costs. It's free. When command cards let you put a card in play, it's a massive tempo gain, and it probably means your opponent is going to catch up to your deck or exceed or go past your deck. Merchant Cast is one, Solaris Contacts is another, Hasty Alliance is a third, and that improved, yeah, there it is,
Yeah,
construction
and
facilities.
so you use that merchant cast, you throw down four cost resources for free. Those resources suddenly provide you a lot more resources.
Yep. And I think Chad Edwards used that exact combination in 2000 when he built his invading crossbows deck. The crossbows from the Crusade expansion are, I think, 7 and 8 cost. And yeah, he was able to produce at least one per turn using that merchant cast improved construction facilities combo. He also included hidden reserves. I mean, there's a reason why these cards, we're talking about them, Chad Edwards won Worlds in 2000 after having taken second the year before. He's an incredibly competitive player, and he realized how pivotal those cards, or how synergistic those cards were.
Awesome.
I think Hasty Alliance, if you want to talk about are cards broken or not broken, I think that's kind of the swirling debate. Your deck.
Well, let's talk about, because I mean, there are relevant competitive scenes, you know, between, you know, Michael being, you know, the one that's kind of leading the charge on the in-person stuff. And so let's focus on the decisions made within that community. And you've been involved with Michael a lot in terms of, all right, what are we going to do? How are we going to, you know, change the meta? And I think, you know, you get the people who are resistant to kind of players making decisions and changing, you know, if it's not official. I'm more of the sense of like, nobody's going to play, you know, Magic the Gathering from 2001 rules. You know, it's like a game evolves as you kind of put more cards on the table. You learn kind of what works, what doesn't work. Developers make mistakes. Cards get banned, you know, or rotted. The community has performed that function, has to perform that function over the time, you know. And so, you know, there's might be debate about who's official. You know, my thing is whoever's running an event is the official, you know. So, you know, Michael hosted that event in December, which, you know, we kind of tongue-in-cheek call Worlds 2025, you know. But it was a tournament with I think about 15 people, you know, and so, which I think is the biggest in-person tournament that's been for a while. But you know, you guys put a lot of thought into what do we need to do to kind of tweak to make the meta viable, so we're not just everyone coming with two decks, and everyone that doesn't come with those two decks is having a bad time. So let's pick on those cards and let's talk about those and why you made those decisions.
Yeah. So in the deck that you have here, I think there are two of the three cards that need to be discussed in terms of what needs to be limited so that you don't have 15 or I think it was 14 players show up with the same decks. Mm-hmm. Hasty Alliance is one of them. Hasty Alliance, like you said, enables you to pay two cost and then pull any unique. Ulrich Kerensky costs 10, and you can pull Ulrich Kerensky, play him for just two resources at any time that you're holding this in your hand and you have another unique down. So it's a great tool for building a deck that has a lot of uniques with very powerful abilities and then be able to pull them with some consistency. The second card that you have in your deck here that synergizes very well with this is Task Force Serpent. And that is a unique card. So it can be pulled by Hasty Alliance. So you can play a two-cost Hasty Alliance card and grab this card from your stockpile, whatever it is. You don't have to worry about waiting to draw it. Grab once you draw one Hasty Alliance. So I'm looking at your deck. You have six Hasty Alliances, which means they'll show up approximately once every 10 cards. That's your first two or three hands. You'll have a Hasty Alliance in your hand. And it looks like you have about 10 unique cards themselves in your deck. So it's very likely that when you pull a Hasty Alliance, you already have a unique card in your hand, possibly even on the table. You play that Hasty Alliance, and now you have this card, Task Force Serpent. And what does Task Force Serpent do? It allows you to then go dig through your deck further. You can dig for up to three unit cards and two more unique cards, show them to your opponent, and then put them into your hand. So you've now just pulled five cards from your deck and put them in your hand for the two-cost Hasty Alliance that you played. And those units, it looks like in this deck you have units that are free deploys. You could immediately start putting those cards down on the table as free deploys and swarm the board now with those units, have the uniques that you want in your hand, and begin playing those with their very powerful abilities. So those two cards synergize very well and very strongly, as your deck masterfully does here. It puts those two cards together with a bunch of free deploy units. The third card that enables sort of the broken combination is the Star League. Yeah, you went there immediately. The Star League allows you to include all of the different factions from the Inner Sphere. So now you can include, unlike your deck that we're looking at that has Dr. Ariel Reed and Contract with Wolf's Runes and Contract with Snort, those are all generic Inner Sphere cards. You can now include a Thomas Merrick and a Theodore Carita and a Romano Lau. and a Victor Steiner Davian, and all of the most powerful unique cards from the Inner Sphere can be included in the same deck. Thanks to the Star League, Hasty Alliance can then repeatedly and consistently pull those very powerful unique cards, including Task Force Serpent, which expedites or speeds up the ability to find all those uniques and find the units that you want. And the three of those cards together is kind of where Worlds ended. In 2000 and 2001, people had started figuring out that combination of three cards.
Yeah.
And I think it was Ben Moffitt in 2000. Mark will double check that. But I think 2000 was Ben Moffitt putting that deck at Worlds. And apparently, I think he was winning Worlds and then had to take some mysterious plane ride home or something like that back to the UK. He had figured that deck out in 2000. Mark has said that in 2001, the deck that won the Ghostbear Elemental deck, that deck won against this type of deck playing with the Star League to enable all of those different uniques to be included, because that unique Hasty Alliance Task Force Serpent Star League deck resource screwed. I think it was lost.
Yeah.
It was a prominent deck archetype in 2000. It's a prominent deck archetype in 2001. And Gauntlet results show that it is still a prominent archetype. Not just that, it's probably the most dominant archetype there is, to the point of making other deck archetypes sink. I think if you allowed that trio of cards to be played together in the same deck, you would end up at Worlds 2025 with 14 versions of that deck, and it would be a who draws and plays the deck best on that. So, and Michael, so, and I, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you're always trying to find the most elegant solution. So there are two tweaks that kind of happen with that, which I think are almost universal within the community in terms of competitive play. You know, is getting rid of the Star League, and I think the big thing with Star League is, it almost feels like a last minute Hail Mary inclusion. You know, it's just from a developer standpoint, I don't see why you would throw a card like this, because essentially you've negated years and years of development where you're constantly balancing cards against each other within factions. And then all of a sudden you're like, all the cards can work together and we haven't done anything to kind of find all the possible combinations. It's definitely seems like kind of a, just like, we know this game is going to end after this expansion because we've lost the license. We're going to throw this in, just kind of mix it up. But it is interesting to compare to the Invading Clans, which basically does the same thing for the clans, which we don't ban. The big thing is because the clans honestly were kind of undeveloped in terms of the unique command cards, and so there's not those threatening combinations there. And the Invaded Clans tends to work by alleviating the clan weakness, which is they just didn't have as much variety of units as the Inner Sphere does, you know. And so, you know, whereas
it enables some really good missions to be put together too, like Steel Viper or Steel Talons and Viper's Maw, which are, I think, Jade Falcon and Steel Viper, I think. So it does get a little bit of that going, but I agree with you. I agree 100% that the Star League has that extra advantage in how much the developers kind of gave to the Inner Sphere as opposed
and
to
the clan. It's interesting to look at, like, the Star League is command cards that it opens up, and that's the issue. Yep. Whereas the Invading Clans doesn't really have an issue with command cards. It's really about widening the available units and missions that are there. And those aren't, there wasn't enough there to kind of break it. So we still play with the Invading Clans. But there's one other kind of tweak that is also pretty much universally accepted on Task Force Serpent, which is that first line, scrap this card when it's revealed, which has been changed to remove it from play. You know, and so whereas before you could use things like the black market connections to use it, and then you pull it back out of your scrap heap, do it again. If you're playing Steiner has basically a more powerful black market connections than Melissa Steiner Davian, which allows you to trade only one card for a card from scrap heap. And of course, if you're playing the Star League, or even not a Star League, in a deck with uniques, you're going to have Melissa Steiner, you're going to Hasty Alliance her, you're going to put her in, and then if you have Task Force Serpent, you're going to create that recursion where you're constantly deploying, you know, or drawing five cards. So those are the two changes I think that, you know, have been made to kind of bring that deck and back down to earth and mean it make it so that as I played it in both of the events with you and lost, it is not unbeatable anymore. So
yeah, gauntlet results for me show that if you play Task Force Serpent as removed from the game after one use, and don't allow it to play with Hasty Alliance and the Star League all together, all three of those together, then Task Force Serpent decks and Hasty Alliance decks are still very successful, but they aren't unbeatable. They lose.
Yeah.
They do lose. And I think your deck, in playing against a lot of the decks at Worlds 2025 and the Assault on Steel City the previous year, like, showed how strong your deck was, but still beatable.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so I think that for anybody who's not played Task Force Serpent, I think your suggestion of playing it as remove from the game once you've used it once, I think is a very appropriate change to the card. All my gauntlet results are based on playing the card that way.
Based on playing it as removed from the game?
Yeah, removed from the game. Gotcha. After one use, yep.
Are there any other kind of fan revisions or rules that you've incorporated into the gauntlet?
Good question. I am very, very, I haven't done too much digging into the Michael Cohen and Chester Hendricks set, the BT Tactics 2. Mm-hmm. And I've not done much digging into your, I think, changes with, you've done a lot of asset-less units with a lot of options, if I'm correct.
Yeah, my changes have been more extensive. So I'm more in terms of, like, we've removed zero-cost units. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that's from Peter Sonholm's suggestion that zero-cost units are problematic, you know, in games in terms of what they open up. And more importantly, limiting design space. There's also changes more structural in terms of the rules. And so I've really embraced this idea of, like, there's every time you have a competitive card game, there's rules that are going to evolve. I mean, if you play Star Wars CCG, great game back in the day, that game looked very different in the first year or two versus it did later on in terms of the amount of kind of rules and tweaks as it go. And so we've kind of embraced that and said, and been, you know, very free to say, okay, well, we're going to make these changes and play them in competitive and make sure they're clear. For me, I'm a BattleTech player that plays the BattleTech trading card game. I think a lot, there are other people in the community that are just people that, you know, I think, and you're one of them too, if the BattleTech trading card game was the Macross trading card game and nothing else was different, all the units, all the cards were the same and it was just branded different, that your enjoyment would still be there for, mm-hmm. you know, and so there's people that play the game because it's a really well-designed game with a very chess-like decision tree, you know, each turn, and that's the attractive. And there's other people that come, this is a BattleTech game, and then they stay because it's, you know, mm-hmm. that tree. And so for me, you know, a lot of my work in developing has been, one, continuing to develop units and bring elements of the BattleTech universe into the game, but we've also tweaked, you know, basic rule sets in order to, one, just kind of allow more design space, you know. And my goal has always been, let's try to, if there are things that tend to tend to narrow that design space and turn and tend to narrow the number of archetypes that are viable, can we tweak that in the least possible way to kind of open that up? And then the other thing too is, I think people realize that people kind of get, you know, in the community that might get fixated on a rule that they don't like. We're not printing 50 million cards, you know, each expansion and sending them out into the world, you know. So if we play a season and we're like, yeah, this isn't working, we just go into Photoshop, change the card, and then put it back out there, you know. And so it's almost like, yeah, it's competitive, we have fun with it, but it's also an ongoing, active, organic development situation, you know, and hopefully the people developing are open to that, you know, and getting that feedback. And for me, it's, yeah, it's like, let's try this. And like this season coming up for Spring League, it's like, okay, well, we had Hidden Reserves was banned in previous seasons, and we're like, all right, let's, you know, we had a player be like, I'd like to see what happens with it. And we're like, all right, let's bring it back and see how it affects the meta and how people can play. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the big thing there.
Yeah.
I think that the game would have been frozen in its mm-hmm. rule sets in 2001, had it continued to 2025, is a naive, I think, perspective.
I agree with you, and I think, again, going back to, I think, something we said very early on, the willingness to put in the time playing the game is so important, because you'll find stuff that you didn't expect, didn't anticipate. You can theorize as much as you want, until you're in a particular situation where someone does something. I remember Chad Edwards, one of the games I played against him, he played a single combat, paid for a unit that was under construction, activated the unit, and tapped single combat to force a battle with my lone unit with the unit that he had just finished constructing. And that left my board entirely undefended. And I said, "What the hell was that, Chad?" He's like, "Oh yeah, that's what we used to always do back in the day."
And I mean, you just things that you're not going to think about on your own, and so you have to stress test your own conception of the game and of the meta, and of the design space in order to kind of find those weaknesses in there. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm always in favor of people playing competitively, and more important, playing competitively with people they don't know and they don't interact with on a regular basis, because that's the only way you're going to kind of, break out of your mindset and your home quote meta, which, I mean, maybe people from four different parts of the country. When you're playing online, that is. But yeah, you got to go into competitive environment with people that you're not familiar with, who haven't come at the game from the same vector, and who want to beat you, and who put in the time to make sure that they can beat you. And then you're like, oh, okay, I understand it now. And that's important. And I think that the stuff we're doing allows that. The online tournaments that we run allow people to come together. They allow it to stress test ideas. For me, as someone who's developing and adding expansions and adding cards, it's like, okay, well, the first step of that is me in my own head putting it on a card, putting an idea. The second step is sharing that with the community and having all people throw their theory crafting in their own head, onto it. But the ultimate is like, okay, we come to that, we find an edit that we want to run with, then you throw in competitive space, and then you're like, someone like you or Michael Dance or John Murphy comes in with a very good deck building skill set, and they're like, I know how to use that card with that other card and this card. And then you're like, oh shit, well, we got a problem here. Or no, or like, or that card really did open up the design space and did what we wanted to.
I think
My big thing, sorry, go.
I saw you change the cost of Saladin the day, like the day or the week after we played at Worlds.
Well, no, I had, well, Saladin had been removed, I think, from the game, because it was a zero cost. That's a zero,
It is zero
two
cost.
M file. And so it had been kind of in that blanket ban of all zero costs, but it was a great unit. And so I was like, oh, let's get this in. So, and a lot of it's very easy, because you can see kind of in the original development that the free deploy mechanic was essentially a get out of jail free card when they there were cards that just didn't have enough value to cost one, or even as zero, they were essentially once you took away those 5 free points, it was a -2 value card, and nobody's going to play a card that's worth -2. And so they started to add things like free deploy to it, which they cost it at one. And the same thing with the Saladin, and so we just like added another kind of handicap mechanic to be like, okay, it's one. You can't just flood the board. You can't have zero resources available, or pay for your two for your Hasty Alliance, pull your Task Force Serpents, pay, get that for free, and then all of a sudden you have 3 units out because you only had 2 resources to pay for that Hasty. And so it's basically a way to say, okay, you got to have a minimum. The goal is it slows down the game just enough so that the cost curve kind of increases, so it's not just 0 to 4 cost units. You're starting to kind of get more in that kind of 3 to 6 cost unit. And again, that's with kind of the organic development, is that, okay, well, now we've just said we've all been playing the game, we've all understand the game where 0 to 4 cost units are viable and you're going to see them everywhere. How does the game play where that cost curve just moves up a little bit? And let's play with that for a couple of seasons. And then if we want to change it back, we can. And that's a great thing, it's just have somebody
That's
in
so
charge that's
healthy.
making. Yeah.
That's so healthy to, like, to take that feedback from whatever, a spring, a
100%.
fall season, take that feedback and, okay, we got to change these cards a little bit, and that way the game, doesn't become stuck. It doesn't become know, 14 players playing Task Force Serpent, Hasty Alliance, and the Star League type decks, you get to see a cool variety of stuff. And I think I'll throw Michael Dance another shout out here. I think with his draft events, you've gotten to see that. You've gotten to see players who, when restricted to a limited amount of cards that are purposefully curated to prevent those kinds of ability spikes, or I think meta spikes is the term that Mike Cohen uses, like when you prevent the use of those cards and you force players to kind of play with good, but all kind of similarly powerful cards, you get to see a lot of creative, cool combos that you didn't see before. And it makes for a very fun, very engaging, a community building type activity and environment.
Yeah. And that's why I like, running different tournament structures too. Sealed is my favorite structure of the tournament because, as I said before, I don't want to look at 1,000 cards and figure out the combinations. Like, I just don't have the time capacity or brain capacity to do that. But give me 100 cards and say, make the best deck out of this, and then give everyone else 100 cards and limit them. All of a sudden I find that that eliminates that weakness, of my kind of time constraint and my kind of my, I do not have the encyclopedic memory of a Mark Roberts or a, or a Michael Cohen to kind of look at those cards. And you can play, and then you can do the draft structure like you and Michael have been working on, and that draft cube is under constant development as well. It's kind of, you guys kind of put all your time into make the cube, put it out there in competitive environment, see where it's broken, see where it's weak, and then make adjustments. And I think that is the healthiest way to kind of, for this fan community to kind of move forward. It's just one, the people playing have to understand that they are essentially the development team for the game. Mm-hmm. You have people at the head of development team where it may be, Michael, if you're talking about Battletech Tactics, it may be me if you're talking about the Revival rule sets, maybe Michael Dance if you're talking about kind of the in-person events. There's someone that has to make the decisions at the top, and then they put it out there, with the feedback of the community. Try it, stress test it. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, change it, develop it. Again, we're not printing 20 million cards and sending them out to, distributors for people to have. And, if we need to change, a cost of a card or text on a card, you just do it. Like this, we have Beetle Active Probe, or the Active Probe was not in the original card game, but it's a very prominent, equipment in the Battletech universe. We've added it, to the cards. I had it in my cards in the previous session. I wasn't really happy with it. I was trying to get it thematic, but it wasn't really powerful or did much or applicable. Michael has his own version where it kind of changes initiative. And then this season I was like, okay, well, we talked with the community. I was like, I don't like this ability. Let's try to make this a little more thematic. Matt hopped in and kind of, made some suggestions. And, Matt's great because Matt will make, 10 suggestions, and, 8 of them might be a little crazy, and, one or two of them was like, oh, hell yeah, that's good. And that's how you develop, right? You can't be shy of making crazy suggestions. Yeah. We ran with it. And so it's great. And so now it's like if your unit is attacking, or when your unit is attacking, the opponent gets -1 initiative. And for me on the development space, negative initiative is something I'm really interested in right now. It did exist in the original game, so it's not completely, it's Sharlar Mori, Comstar card gave negative initiative. Yep. And for me, I'd really like to see more pilots in the game, more command cards, because the people of the Battletech universe are interesting. I grew up reading the novels, and so I don't want to just see mechs. And if you suddenly start throwing negative initiative on it and pilots are your way to get positive initiative, all of a sudden you need to have pilots, and so you can play with that and you can say, all right, well, let's play with negative initiative and see if that has the attendant effect of, forcing people to play more pilots, and put them in, and suddenly they're more relevant. So yeah, it's fun. I think the biggest thing is the mindset. People have to understand one, some ideas are going to be amazing. Some are going to be crap. The rest are going to be just right. And then you test it and then you change it and you move on. You take community, feedback and you kind of adjust. So
yeah, I think being flexible to change and being open to suggestions and being open to taking some ass whipping. Like I've gotten my ass totally kicked left and right. Like Chad beat me up a number of times before I started figuring stuff out, and being comfortable with that, I think is the, I mean, That's the way to grow. Like as a competitor, like you grew up playing a bunch of competitive sports, like you
Yeah.
know you're gonna take your ass whippings, and you know you're like, okay, what did I learn from that? How did I do that play wrong? What card should I have used instead?
Yeah.
And you know you get on with it and you get better.
And Chad is such a was such a great resource because there's a natural desire to teach there. You know, whereas some people are just like, oh, I crushed you. I'm happy. I'm gonna move on with the rest of my night. Whereas Chad is like, oh, this is why I attack one unit at a time. You know, this is why, Calm Guard response team is great. I've never seen that before. All of a sudden this thing is doing four damage to me because you're including the target in attack. So yeah, it's just, all these crazy things. You know, all of a sudden, what are these Saladins? I just disregarded this as a nonsense card. You know, when am I gonna to Alpha Strike a card and lose it for two turns? You know, so but yeah, it's having those players in, and if people out there can adopt. And I mean, the evolution has happened with you guys too with the draft cube. You know, we played a new archetype that was included in the draft cube of mercenary contracts, and it proved that it was just a little bit too aggressive. It played a little bit too much like a constructed deck. And so now Michael's going back and you guys going back and being like, all right, well, what's the other kind of archetype we can open up in this draft cube? And that willingness to adapt is critical. And not printing cards. And a lot people ask me all the time, it's like, can't buy these cards. Can I do this? And I'm like, well, if you want to like pull all the files out of Lackey and print them on your own, you can, but I'm not, these cards aren't under constant development. There's very few cards that I'm like, that's it. We nailed it. I'm not going to change it again. And those cards I'll have that where 2 years later I'll be like, all right, I thought it was set, but now we're going to tweak this. So having everything digital and playing online and lets you do that. You know, and you can still, throw the files onto a color printer, print them out, play them at home, and not have to worry about sending them to a, place like Make Playing Cards, which will make like a pretty much 95% close to accurate, professional print. So it's fun. It's good.
Yeah, I got a question for you. What card have you come up with that you think you're most proud of?
Card of a the I mean the that's a good question. I mean the I think the card that inspired me to change and I love was originally Captain Natasha Kerensky, which I now changed the name to the Black Widow, so it's called the Black Widow in my sets. It is perfectly thematic to the character, I think, and it doesn't really add any crazy new mechanics. So I'll pull it up. People can get a preview of unpublished cards so far. Where we got deck editor.
They're going to start thinking about what deck they can build around the Black Widow, huh?
So one, probably my favorite piece of BattleTech art on the card. Looks amazing. So this she was the first time we added armor as a pilot ability, so adding armor to a unit. And so we did that with generally the way it said was like if you take a pilot in the game, four gunnery, five piloting skill is the baseline for a normal pilot. And the game was like, well, if this pilot is a two gunnery and a three piloting skill, then that equates to plus two attack and plus two initiative. You know, pretty simple thing there. And so, but you start to get to these monster pilots that would have plus five initiative. And I was like, that's kind of gets redundant after a point. What else can we do? All right, well, let's say that instead of 2 points of initiative, let's convert that into extra armor, which kind of, equates to just a more battlefield awareness and more evading other units. So, we start to add plus armor to pilot abilities. Her ability is basically sharpshooter. She fucking kills people, and so it's just a refined sharpshooter, which we talked about earlier in this, and that's her ability. She's called the Black Widow for a reason. And then we added that you can't modify the dice rolls to keep it kind of under control, and so, but yeah, I mean, you throw Black Widow, you basically, if you're, and she's, gonna deal at least six damage to a unit, and so if she focuses down a unit, you roll the dice six times, chances are that unit's gonna be scrapped every time. And so it's just a, very thematic card for her. Honestly, the hardest part was costing. It's hard cost. I mean, very easy costing units. There's a formula. You do it. Sometimes you need a round. But it's like, what's the cost of Black Widow? Is she four? Is she five? Is she six? Everybody has their opinion. It's funny that yeah, there's people that are always like, Michael Cohen's is going to be like, this should be six. It's like hard on this should be six. And I talked to Peter Sundholm, and Peter's like, four. maybe three, you know, and I'm like, well, I'm going
to
go
with
Peter.
He wants to play Picard. He wants to play.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm going to go with the world champion when I'm kind of, here and there on it. But yeah, so yeah, Pilot, I love it. The art is amazing. And then the next one, the first time I really kind of embraced the Negative Initiative was Major Adam Steiner. And so
okay,
this was, it's still kind of looking for the main thing, but the thing at the bottom, your opposing player gets a negative two initiative, and so it's like, okay, we're bringing in pilots. It's shutting them down. One, either they're not going to be able to play any of the mission cards in their deck if you're putting this in, or they need to start responding with other pilots of their own to kind of balance it out. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to expand that with other cards. Oh gosh, who do we have? I can't remember who all the other ones have, but yeah, they're in there. We're just adding more negative initiative. So it's being like, okay, well, let's play that initiative game, which is what happens on the battlefield. It's all positioning. Yep. I mean, you look at, Napoleonic battles, all it is maneuvering on the battlefield. Who's got the initiative? As soon as you have the initiative in that battle, you win, because, you're responding to what the other person is doing. And so, and this is fun. And, for me, I just, I think about, okay, what was Major Adam Steiner? What was his character? What were his strengths and weaknesses? Information was ammunition. And so, his information is allowing him to kind of, always stay one step ahead of his opponent. So if his opponent, isn't, really keen, then they're going to be shut down. And so making those thematic things in the cards is something that, I've had fun and enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see your interest in the Battletech world outside of the card game. Like you're able to imbue some of the stuff that they missed in the original CCG in here kind of thing, because you're right, like I don't think they got the Lost Initiative, like Charlotte Mori I think was the first one, and then a couple of cards in the last expansion, the Crusade expansion, got into that.
Charlotte Mori was the original. So sometimes there's something I just completely knew that will take. I think one of mine was the cluster ability, and so let's say Gargoyle. So a lot of the units I've refined. So the Gargoyle used to be the Man of War Prime. And so it has, its autocannon is LBX, which is basically a shotgun style autocannon where most autocannons shoot slugs. And so we added that cluster ability. That's just, it acts like a missile, except it lacks the long range ability. So you have to roll a die. And you can do 1, 2, or 3 damage, which is basically why people play that shotgun style autocannon in the game, because they want to try to, the more damage you get, the more chances you get of getting like a special crit through and doing a special damage. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, throwing things. And then, you have other ones that are just, I've been struggling, every time you get a new thing, you're struggling to get it, figure out how it works in the game. Whoop, it's not in there right now. Let's see. I have the Uziel. No, what's another one? Yeah, some of these are, if I had Photoshop open here. Yeah, I'd have to do other screen shares, but they're in there. But the units and finding new abilities, I think, actually, I think one of the hardest one was your Naga. And so in the Battletech universe, your Naga's famous. He was in a battle with Morgan Kell, and they essentially get to this point where their mechs drop off their radar and they're blind, and it's called a phantom mech ability. And so, and they couldn't get shot, and they just kept shooting, couldn't hit each other. And then they basically, conceded to a draw, of the thing. And so it's like, how do I bring that into the game? And it's like, all right, well, let's do this ability. I'll say once per game. It's not something you do all the time. Once per game, all the damage is reduced, but then, in the universe, like one of those pilots kind of was so shooken by, he like went and, went to a monastery and was there for like 10 years until he came back. And this one kind of, backed off and retired and, and kind of went in shame to the coordinator of the Combine because he couldn't vanquish his enemy. And so it's like, okay, well, how do we take that story, put it into the card? All right, use this ability. Great. You saved your unit. Your guys aren't dead, but you got to restock them. They go back to stockpile. They're not still on the board. And then maybe you can use other ways to bring them back onto the table, but it takes some work, just like it did in the novel. Took time, took certain circumstances to get them back on the battlefield. And so for me, knowing the background of the characters and the story, and then trying my best to infuse that into a card. That's the fun part of the development for me.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And for the units, it's really just the art. Like if I see another cool piece of art, I'm like, let's make a unit out of it.
I think you've done, from what I've seen, because I'm part of both the Facebook groups, when your updates ping, like you are so in connection with like the artists or finding the art that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think
I mean that's
the art to me. Like I remember as a kid, like part of my draw to the game was like this really cool kind of futuristic but dystopian art about these super advanced people somewhere, you know, and that's all I kind of understood of BattleTech as a kid. And even now, I've never read a novel or played the tabletop, like, but the art there's an aspect to the card game of the art that is very alluring.
I love, and that's, you know, I have the Gallery 3025 Patreon, which is basically just a Patreon where a community can pool its funds, and then we use that funds to do commissions. You know, for people that are part of that Patreon and are like, why haven't I heard anything for the last 2 years? We've been gathering funds. MechWarrior Bulldogs here at first. MechWarrior Bulldogs is becoming a full animation. So you're talking thousands of dollars raised over multiple years of kind of not gone, just dormant. We're two months into developing that into full animation. But yeah, the art is important. I mean, the art, I remember going to Walden Books and staring at Way of the Clans novel cover, which is a dire wolf walking past the building and a soldier's just sitting there hiding as like this giant monstrous robot walks past. And I was like, holy shit. And, like, I always imagined myself not in the mech, but as the dude in the building, broken down building, being like, oh shit, you know, what do I do? Yep. So taking the art and kind of putting it onto the cards, you know, is great. So, and we, yeah, like here's like the Timberwolves. Like, I love this art. This might be my favorite fan art. When I first saw this, I was like, oh, what's that? I scrolled by, you know, I was like, that's crap. It's just dark. I can't see it. And then I came back to it and I looked at it.
Can you hover over the card with your cursor and make it bigger?
Yeah, is it boop, boom, make it bigger?
If you go straight across the text,
I'm gonna have to.
There you go. Yeah. What's going on there?
So this is, you know, the book, you know, the Legend of the Jade Phoenix trilogy. This is Aiden Pride's last stand, where he's basically holding the line against overwhelming forces as the dropships escape. And at first I was like, oh, this is just a lot of mess. Yeah, I can see it's kind of a Timberwolf. But then I look, like, you see the dropships going off the background. It's at night. That mech is damaged beyond repair. He's not making it out of there. It's just, I love it. And then I got to make a card out of it, you know? Yeah. And that was another thing I do with my custom cards. And you'll see one thing here that doesn't appear in the original game is you have a nested Alva Strike overheat. You know, and so one of the big things with the original game and the cards is that there's not really a rhyme or reason to overheat. You know, it's not directly tied to how many heat sinks a mech has. You know, some mechs have enough heat sinks to dissipate all the heat from the weapons, some don't. And it's formulaic. You either have enough to fire all the weapons, or you have enough to fire half your weapons or two-thirds of your weapons. So it's a very easy math equation. And so, you know, it was just going back to the units and being like, okay, well, how many weapons can this fire and how much damage can it do before it starts to overheat? And then what damage can it do when it overheats more? And then the Alpha Strike was another thing that I changed in development. Is Alpha Strike used to be just related to autocannons. You know, so if you had an autocannon, you got Alpha Strike, which is like, okay, well, missiles use ammunition, machine guns use ammunition. Like, all these other things use and a missile system uses ammunition. So why would just an autocannon have Alpha Strike? And so all of a sudden, Alpha Strike became tied to all weapons, but then it wasn't just automatically for all weapons, because some units carry very little ammunition and some carry more than enough ammunition. So it was like, you know, I calculated in the tabletop, how many turns is a normal battle? Usually it's around 10 to 12 turns. Maybe a little more, maybe 14, 15 at the most. So I was like, okay, well, any unit that has 15 or more reloads for a weapon doesn't have Alpha Strike, because it has more than enough ammo to get through the battle. If it does, if it has less than that, then it gets Alpha Strike, you know? And so if it has 7, reloads for a weapon, then definitely gets Alpha Strike, and you got to pay more to reload it. So Timberwolf only has one volley, per LRM-20 that it has. And so it's like, all right, that's Alpha Strike. But it also develops heat to use those weapons. And so you have to overheat, and then you get Alpha Strike, and then you can get access to your missile. Mm-hmm. And so that was another thing. And also, you can do that in original game by adding certain enhancements to the cards, by adding an Alpha Strike overheat. But mm-hmm. it was just an idea that just clicked one day, a year and a half into development. I was like, wait a second, why don't I nest this, and all of a sudden it opened up a ton of design space. And then awesome. We're talking about art. Like, I saw this art. I was like, holy shit, that is awesome fan art. Mm-hmm. And it was just some commission that a fan had, and they shared it. And it was not a standard Timberwolf, so I just went in and kind of used the design rules for Battletech to make a Timberwolf that fit with that art. And then I made a card out of it, and there we go. So a lot of that's fun.
Very cool, man. You're doing awesome stuff.
Appreciate it.
Anything else you want to know about the gauntlet or what I'm doing?
I think... What was, we were talking kind of epiphanies and design space and favorites and design. Mm-hmm. What was a deck for you that was kind of like a paradigm shift or something unexpected in a particular deck or something that just, it just kind of gave you an epiphany in design or understanding about how the decks work? Is there a particular gauntlet that you want to review from that kind of dimension, from that perspective?
I can pick two. Okay. Two kind of come to mind right away. They're probably my two favorite decks to play with. Neither of them is mine, so I can't take credit for either of them. Mm-hmm. As much fun as it is to play, Tormano's Bombs, it's a pretty straightforward deck, like what you have to do with it. The two decks I think that blew my mind the most, Tom Smith's Gorge Master, for sure. I wrote about it in the article. I think I hinted at it a little bit, just the one that I posted tonight earlier. The number of different things. Yeah, there it is. The number of different things that this deck can do and do well. The optionality of the deck is so off the charts. I don't know the history of it. Mark Roberts would have to chime in here, like how this deck came about. I know that it had some stages of development and different people, I think Mark has said before, were playing it. It wasn't just Tom Smith's ideas, but just understanding how to play the deck, that it's a C3 deck, but only half the units are C3. The other half of the units, practically almost all of them have jump. Why do they all have jump? Well, that synergizes with the studied move that's in there. Why is that important? Well, the studied move has access to then pull Forged Mission Orders, Blitzkrieg, or Final Push, which are all different ways of pushing damage unblocked through and wouldn't be known to your opponent because you're playing the studied move as a mission. They would have to assign their blockers before that happened. Mm-hmm. So regardless of what they do, they block with several patrol units and you use a studied move to get the Blitzkrieg back and go past all their patrol units, or they have a bunch of guarding units. Okay, I'll use the Final Push and send a bunch of damage through on guarding units, or they block with a lone unit for its mission orders. I think the nuance of the deck and the amount of thinking that you have to do while playing the deck and the understanding that you have to have, because it's also a 2/7 swarm, it's also a C3 deck. It's either this deck, I think, was the most revolutionary in the way that I thought about the game, or Zvi Moshevitz's Mechless deck from 98. I think those two decks make me think more about... If you don't have that deck, I can show you that one. I'll share it here. I think those two decks make me think more about my lackey got closed. I got to pick back up. Okay, make me think more about how to play the game correctly than any other. And I think that's what Battletech is for me. It's the multiplicity of choice that you have in any given scenario, the deployments, the battle that you're going to engage in, the mission that you can play. That's a Rassel Hog deck. Optional deck. Can you see all those cards on screen there pretty well?
Yep.
I think this is unmodified one. I might be slightly wrong on that. One or two cards might be off, but that there's no units in here. is the first mind-boggling thing.
Yeah.
And then going, going from there, that as your draw decides how you play the deck. Like that's a totally foreign concept to me until I started playing this deck that you're, or Tom Smith's deck, that your draw, that your deck is so multiplistic in what it can do that you decide on your opening hand, this is how I'm going to play this deck. Like if you draw logistics and a resource broker, you want to get one of those resource brokers down immediately to start amassing counters that you'll dump onto a corridor of fire near the end of the game to do 70 damage unblockable at once. Or if you draw a bunch of mining operations, you want to get a logistics down and just plop, 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 plop. They're all free deploys and get them all down there. If you early corridor a fire card, his fireball, you want to then start using the ore funds that are in this deck to start pulling all the staging grounds because they at the time were the only resource that did three or earned three construction counters for any card. You can just drop those three construction counters. Or if you drew a bunch of zero cost resources, you could possibly use rapid deployment to then dump those resources out one after another and have 12 resources on the table on turn four, thanks to all the hidden reserves that are in there. So the nuances of this deck and the nuances of Tom Smith's deck, I think, showed me in a similar way, like in a similar way to playing Chad Edwards, showed me how much there was to the game and how deep you could go into, they do this, I'll do this, or if I draw this, I'll do this. And that kind of challenge of the challenge to your mind to figure out how am I going to use this random collection of seven cards that I just picked up on turn one or turn two to beat this deck across from me, I think is part of, I mean, it's part of the allure and the fun of the game, I think. But for me, I think that's kind of, it's kind of the quintessence. That's like the juice that's in the fruit, so to speak, of playing this game. And I think those two decks, I think more than any other, there's a reason they both did well at Worlds. Tom Smith's won. I think Tom Smith's deck is the best deck that's been in any deck list for Worlds, and probably the best outside the ranks on the gauntlet. 25 years ago, he came up with that. It's a masterpiece. And how he figured that out, it still baffles or blows my mind. But those two decks, I think, when I'm playing Battletech, what I like about Battletech and the thinking and the subtlety and the responding to what my opponent's doing with just slightly better, I think it is, that's the juice that's worth the squeeze for me.
Yeah, it's funny because my you talked about multiple vectors of, toward victory. And my favorite deck to play in my own rule set, the Revival rule set, is a it was just a boom bear. So I wanted to play. I love Aletheia Kebrinski as a pilot. And so I was just like, all right, well let's take Terry Sohnholm's deck and let's just find substitute bear stuff into it. And as it evolved, I don't think it evolved that much. It evolved a little bit, but it has Bjorn, Con Bjorn Jorgensen, which helped with the resource hunting. It has a typical mission superior nav, but it has single combats, and so one, the it was built to be like, all right, well, let's hunt resources. But the more I played it, the more I was like, this deck can do anything based on the situation. So this can be a resource hunting deck. I can start hunting units if he's getting too much units out. All of a sudden, it's a unit hunting deck. It could be a speed deck to try to get that stockpile as quick as possible if he's just building big units and I can't get things out fast enough, or maybe as a merchant cast and I can't get out rid of the resources quick enough. And so it just became this deck where it basically had three or four different strategies for when that could evolve in the moment based on what kind of deck my opponent was playing. And I have the most fun playing with it. I mean, anybody that plays the leagues know they've seen it. I play it a lot. If you watch the gameplay on on the Renegade HPG, there's plenty there in the Constructed that have that deck. But yeah, it's a
Thanks
lot
for
of fun.
thanks for putting those out. Thanks for
Oh
putting
yeah.
like gameplay is a great way for somebody who has only played the game once or twice, or it was interested, watch some of that gameplay and watch ask yourself, why did they pick that card? Why did they pick that card to deploy? Or why did they attack with that group and not just one unit? Like, you'll learn. You'll like, getting to watch you, who's experienced at it, or getting to watch Chad Edwards play. Like, that's how I picked up so many tricks and understanding.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's fun. And when I started out, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to edit all the kind of quiet pausing and kind of cut it down, which just took a ton of time and I couldn't do much. And then I was like, people can skip. What am I doing? Like, and like my universal recommendation is play it at 150% speed at least, and kind of go through and kind of make it faster. But yeah, people can skip through. And then on now it takes me 30 minutes to edit it and put it out there. And so, it's just kind of a ways you find kind of be more efficient with your time. So I cut down 3 hours, 4 hours of editing a game to make it, and people don't care. People don't care if they have to sit there, or if they have to like click a 10-second jump.
Yeah.
So it's easy. I just take the raw footage, no edits, throw it out. But yeah, no, that's great. I'm glad people are enjoying it. I mean, sometimes I was like, 500 people watch me play BattleTech, in the stream. I love it. I mean, it's great. Uh-huh. If I wish those people would kind of join the league and we could get some, dozens of people in the league, that would be amazing. So, but hopefully these videos can kind of, get people over that intimidation hump, being a novice and get out there.
I think the familiarity, and I know, I think Michael Dance is his, I think he's planning the event in June this year, or May or June, or we have, I don't think he's picked the final date yet, but a boot camp, I think, is what he wants to call it. He's calling it boot camp or something like that. And his goal is for, I think, the first day, having a bunch of new players, like how many players can I get to play this game for the first time that day? And I know I've volunteered, and he was already going to do it, like not even participating in the event, but walking around and like checking out hands of cards that people have and kind of helping them understand what can this hand of cards that you're sitting with do in this moment with what's across the board from you and what's on your board here. And like that teacher aspect that you talked about, Chad Edwards, wanting to, like, there's always a fine line you have to walk, like wanting to show your secrets and at the same time wanting to give your secrets to somebody else to use against you, but to understand the game better and then solve the game better. And I think, at World 25, John, that moment when John Murphy showed me all those decks, I was just like, there it is. Like that is, as I'll be diplomatic, as much as beating you was great and fun and winning it all, like that moment, like to me meant a lot more as a human being than whatever else, than winning a match or something like that.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's funny because I do work in my coaching career. I coach rowing, and I produced a lot of content over COVID where it was kind of lecture style. I would just sit down and talk about training methodology. This is why you do this. This is how you understand it. This is how you build a workout. This is why you do this. This is how you structure it. I mean, hundreds of hours of just talking, long form. So videos were generally 15 to 30 minutes. So crunchy. So like university style, definitely not the kind of, flashy, kind of quick, ADD style YouTube.
As
you know, with the gauntlet, you send it out there and mostly you hear crickets, there's not a whole lot of feedback, but you say, but they're out there. They're hearing it, they're taking it in. Not everybody clicks like or makes a comment that's kind of consuming the material. And every once in a while you get that holy cow moment where you're like, this is helping people. Like I doubt John Murphy would be playing if he didn't have a combination of the BattleTech tactics cards, exciting about the cards, and then your work with the gauntlet of kind of helping him expand the game. And so, and the same thing for me, someone will just randomly send me a comment and like I said, one coach emailed me. No coach had, directly emailed me to say thank you, but it was like, look, this has been great. I'm a new coach, coaching in this division, and I've like really, your content has really helped me. And I got named, coach of the year for my conference, and a lot of it's because of that. And it's just like, holy shit, it's just like, and so for me on YouTube, you hit, publish and you hear crickets most of the time, maybe you get some comments. And so, I do encourage the people out there to kind of at least stop and say, hey, this is helping me, because it does, help us go on. You've spent thousands and thousands of hours on the gauntlet. I've spent thousands of hours making YouTube videos, and so But ultimately, I think what I was saying that is that there is, for the rowing content, like I've talked to other coaches, and I had an interview once where it was funny. I was talking to a coach of a, top school that had, won the NCAAs for women. So you're talking about top one, two, maybe three school a year. And the coach and I was like, and we're talking about basically performance standards. I was like, well, what's the performance standards that you look in your like 2V or your 3V, boat? And she's like, well, I can't share that. And it was like, it was, for me, someone who was just like, teach. Like my goal is to teach. Like I'm not trying to kind of save my knowledge, for myself and not share it. My goal is to get it out. And my philosophy is if you can, one, I'm really, really good at coaching with this knowledge I have. If you can take my knowledge and beat me, then one, you're either better than me and I can learn from you, or your athletes are better than my athletes. And ultimately it's about the athletes. It's about us serving the athletes as best we can. But it just shocked me, and I was like, okay. And I quickly moved on. I don't think it showed in the interview, but internally I was like, why wouldn't you share that information? It's not even like your first varsity performance standards. It's like your third varsity. And then I reached out to another athlete who had set a world record about, hey, do you want to hop on the podcast and talk about your training? It's like, well, I don't want to reveal my secrets. And I was like, okay, one, there's maybe three other people in the world that could possibly like challenge you if they knew your secrets. But yeah, chances are it's not gonna work that way. So it's just, you gotta be like, yeah, I want you to do well. I want to see those other people playing well. And so you share what you know, and that's the teacher in me. And yeah, I could hoard all my knowledge and not tell anybody, and you could do that. And then we're all worse because then we're all in our head cannon. We're all theory crafting and we're not getting that experience and kind of pushing it out there. So, but yeah.
I John Murphy played heavy fog against me in that first game of the draft championship at Worlds 25, and like it's still in my head. Like it's still in my head, him doing that. And it was a fucking phenomenal play. Like it was a great play. And I was just like, damn, like you killed two of my units. Damn. Like you won the game with that play. And I was like, it stung. But then you're like, you get it. Like you're like, oh, the community is that much better. It's that much stronger. It's like now I've got to up my game even more kind of thing.
Oh,
So
100%.
yeah.
Yeah, you learn from the bruises you take along the way more than from the successes. Like I could definitely kind of talk about the hard losses I took as a rower, but most of the wins kind of fade away in time. It's like I couldn't even tell you or recall what the wins were, but I can tell you the losses where I did something fucking stupid. I can tell you about my
They did
first
something
cross.
fucking great.
Yeah, I can tell you about my first cross country race where I went to Dunkin' Donuts and ate a dozen donuts on the bus to my cross country race, and then puked up in like a twirling, whirlwind around a tree at the finish line. So yeah, you learn, but I don't know when my best race was. So yeah, and that's the same. You learn from those lumps. But this has been great, Kevin. I definitely would like to do it again. If you want to, if your game, maybe reconnect, and we can kind of break down, do a shorter episode. We don't have to do 2.5 hours every time, but 30 minutes and just break down a gauntlet, and just like, because there's a lot of kind of crunchy stuff, that's
Talk about a couple of decks and why they work and how they work and all that kind of stuff.
And
There's a
more
lot of
importantly,
material.
the invite's there. Let's get some gameplay video out, online game video, and kind of show some people so we can kind of test some of those gauntlet decks and see what
I'm
happens.
down for both of those
Maybe
things.
a rematch, maybe a Worlds 2025 rematch, try to bring those decks, but yeah, let's do it.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me on here.
My pleasure, Kevin. Thanks for joining us, and thanks everyone for watching. And yeah, come join us on the community. I'll put the Facebook group in the links. You can drop a comment. I'll put the Discord server. I'm more hesitant with that because the bots tend to really latch on to Discord invites and they hop on and then spam the thing. But find me. There's plenty of ways to find me online and I'll kind of get you guys hooked up. But yeah, Michael Dance is going to be the guy to go to, to help you get set up for in-person play or try to build a community area. And for the online play, there's always people that are happy to kind of guide new players through a tutorial. So don't be intimidated. Again, if you're a busy guy or a dad like me that can't go out and play on the tabletop too much, it's very easy to hop online, play a 30, 45 minute game of BattleTech and kind of get your fill of the universe, before going to bed at night. So good stuff. All right.
Yep.
Thanks, everyone.
Good talking with you, Travis.
Same here, Kevin.
ETA dropship, 1 minute. Shutdown sequence initiated.